So if you know that a carrot's going to take you 1 minute of running and a chocolate cake is going to take you 20 minutes of running, then it might help or nudge you towards eating the carrot. We've got a small number of people who experience an eating disorder, but we've also got 60% of the population that are overweight. And many of those people that are overweight are dying of diseases that could have been prevented had they not been overweight. I think the thing that bothers me the most is when I get phone calls from parents of children who have got eating disorders. You know, you can't not be moved by that, and you know, you do have to reflect on, is this worth it, and is this really the right thing to do? IVF was hugely controversial, chemotherapy was hugely controversial, but could you imagine a life where we don't have those treatments? So just because something's controversial and it might have negative effects for one population, does it mean that we discount it? I guess I'm going to choose not to answer that question because I think it's unfair.
Hello and welcome to the Experts in Health podcast brought to you by Loughborough University. This podcast aims to highlight the latest research and trends in health as we welcome a variety of guests from a host of different disciplines. I'm Dr. Chris McLeod, an academic in the School of Sport, Exercise and Health Sciences with an expertise in behavioural nutrition and public health. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Amanda Daly. And Amanda is a Professor of Behavioural Medicine at Loughborough University. Amanda, it's wonderful to have you on the podcast. Thanks very much for coming.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for the invitation. It's great to be here.
Not at all. And here is the Elite Athlete Centre at Loughborough University. Do you feel the same as me, where you feel like you probably should be doing a bit more exercise when you come in here? That's how I feel, anyway.
Well, I had a run this morning, 40-minute run, so I feel like I've done my exercise for the day and I won't be doing any more, so, that's...
What is your exercise regime? How much do you do a week?
So I like to try and get 4 or 5 40-minute runs in a week and then 2 to 3 boot camps on top, because the running's good, but you've got to keep your muscles, you know, strong and think about core as well to support the running, so yeah.
That's intense. It sounds intense.
Yeah, yeah.
You enjoy it there?
Yeah, I definitely enjoy it. It's a way of life. I've done it all my life. I think it's important to practice what I preach. So when people ask me this question, I can say, you know, I do it. I know it's hard, but you've got to commit to it because it's important for health.
Well, we'll get into the practicing what you're preaching as over the course of this podcast. But just to help our listeners and viewers, can you give us a bit of an outline as to, you know, who you are and what you do?
Yep, so yeah, I'm a Professor of Behavioural Medicine here at Loughborough. I joined in 2018. So I started just before COVID, so I had about a year before COVID. So that was sort of quite interesting, coming to a new university and then going straight into COVID. But so I'm the Director of the Centre for Lifestyle Medicine and Behaviour at Loughborough, where our main kind of goal is to develop research programmes, to develop good health policy. You know, we do the research and then someone else develops the policy. And I'm also NIHR research professor in public health. So I get quite a nice pot of money from the Department of Health and Social Care to develop programs of work around health and well-being. One of those is PACE labelling and health communication, which we'll obviously talk about today. But we do other things like programs of work around prevention, around women's health, children's health, digital health. So we've got lots of different things going on within that.
And
keeps
how,
me busy.
Yeah, I can imagine. For our listeners and viewers, they might not have heard the term behavioural medicine before. How would you describe what is behavioural medicine?
Yeah, I guess it's fundamental basis. Behavioural medicine is really about bringing the mind and the body together, the physical and the mental, and thinking about how those two things might interact to impact behaviour. Obviously, in our case, we're most interested in medicine and in health. So it's really taking the person as a whole being and thinking about how those two things can interact in that person's life. And I think it's really important that we do that because we are a physical and we are a mental, and it's really important that we approach people when we want them to change their health with both of those things in mind.
And do you have a particular area that you look to change people's health through, as in like a type of location or a type of practitioner, or is it in their own home? Where do you sort of aim your work?
So one of the key, I mean, there's a few different areas. One of the key areas is really thinking about how we can use health professionals in the NHS to really drive and nudge behaviour. I mean, there are millions and millions of consultations going on in the NHS every day. That's a massive resource that we've got for us. So one of the things that we're interested in is how can we use that resource to get people to really think about their behaviour in relation to physical activity and health, not least because we're using those services and those health care professionals all the time, so it's a constant resource that we can keep nudging and pushing the public. So we're quite interested in training and organising healthcare professionals to do that.
Yeah, no, it's all really interesting stuff. And in relation to what we're going to talk about today, can you just give us a brief opening statement, sort of whet our appetites to say why what we are going to talk about today is important to you and should be important to the people listening?
Well, we all eat. And we all go shopping and we all make decisions about what we buy and what we eat. And it's really important for us to engage our minds in those decisions. We shouldn't be passively buying and consuming food. I think we should think about it. And so obviously one of the things we're going to talk about today is PACE labelling as a form of communication. And it's at its core, at its principle, it's trying to encourage people to engage in that thought process about what it is that they buy and what it is that they eat. The idea being that when you do that, that the outcome is a better, healthier decision than when you don't.
Do you, in your mind, do you think most people engage in their food choices when they're at that point of picking up, going, yeah, I'm gonna have a Mars bar today, or whatever it is? Do you think people do have that active engagement?
No, I think people engage in terms of price. I think that's particularly important at the moment in terms of cost of living. And I think when you see a bargain in the supermarket and it's got the yellow sticker on, that's probably the driver of decisions rather than actually what the food is and the content of the food. But I think it's important that we think of strategies that help people make those decisions. Whether they do or not, you might decide, well, that's neither here nor there, but I think as public health practitioners, it's our job to educate the public or at least put the right strategies in place to allow people to make the right decisions. Whether they do, clearly we want them to, but first and foremost, that's our job, Chris. That's not everybody else's job, and that's, I think, really important for us to engage in when we're thinking about strategy.
So we have a strategy that's quite, you know, widespread in the UK at the moment about labelling on food. What is the current labelling practice? And for the particular labelling that we have, why have we come to have that particular labelling at this point?
So at the moment, front of pack labelling actually is voluntary. It's not compulsory. Everybody thinks it is, but it's not. But most manufacturers sign up to front of package labelling. And at the moment in this country, we use traffic light labelling to try and alert customers to whether a food is a good food or a not so good food. So I've actually brought an example here to show you. So here's a typical example.
One you made earlier.
Yeah, so we've got green, orange and red following a typical traffic light process. So based on whether or not something is wholly green, red or amber, the idea is that can educate the public about whether that's a healthy food or not. So if I was looking at that, I might think, well, actually, there's three segments there that are green. There's one red and one amber, so that's a healthy food. But that's not always the case. You need quite developed cognitive understanding to actually really work out whether this is a good food or a bad food or less healthy food for you to buy. The other thing we've got is per portion. So it might say 30 grams of this particular food will contain X, Y and Z calories or X, Y and Z fat. So when you're in the supermarket, you then have to work out if this has got 265 grams, then you have to work out what the proportion of that is. So you actually need quite developed mathematical skills to work out whether this is a healthy food or not. And I guess one of the propositions we've made is that actually this is quite complicated for the public, and it actually requires quite high levels of health literacy to understand whether that's a good food to buy or not. But that's the system that we have, and that's what we're kind of working towards.
Do you know why those particular categories that are on there have been put there? Because there's fat, but then there's this thing there called sat fat and cal and salt, and I don't see other things like pro, maybe protein, or carbohydrates. So yeah. Do you know why those particular categories have come on?
I don't particularly know why. I think those are the main kind of drivers of nutritional content, and those are the things that historically we've focused on in relation to how we educate the public about what's in the food. And I guess one of the things that I'm quite interested in is to review that and to pause and to think, is there a different way in which we can present information to the public that makes it really easy for them to understand? So you can have a view about whether this is the right thing or not, but I think it's always important for us to review and update how we give information to the public. And I'm quite interested, as you know, in changing the way in which we give information to the public, because I feel quite strongly that it's our duty to make it really easy for the public to understand what they're buying and what they're eating.
So you would say that it's a good thing or helpful thing to have some sort of labelling on foods. Is that, do you think it is a good thing to have some sort of labelling?
Yeah, and I think I haven't heard anybody say that they think it's a bad thing. Mm-hmm. I think the more information in some ways that you can give the public, the better. It's just how you do it and the actual nature of the information that you give. If you're going to give information, you might as well give it about health in the right way, in an accessible way. And I also think we've got a responsibility to make it really easy for different segments of the population. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering about, you know, children. You know, child obesity isn't going away anytime soon. So how do we educate our children about making the right healthy decisions? Mm. And so I think we should reflect on, okay, so we're labelling food in this way. How easy is it for a child to be able to understand when they go in the shop? We want them to be autonomous decision makers in their food, but we actually set them up to fail. We actually make it really, really hard for them to make healthy decisions based on the current types of traffic labelling approach.
And what does the academic literature say about these current labels? Do they work? Do they work for some people and not for others? Yeah. You know, or, you know, what's the problem with them if there is a problem?
Yeah, so I mean, there's been quite a lot of evidence around different types of labelling, and I think at the moment the current evidence is that the relationship between change in behaviour and labelling is small mm-hmm. at best, and I am aware of other groups that have conducted and updated sort of systematic reviews which confirms that. So if we agree mm-hmm. that the effect is small, but that doesn't mean that something small is not good. At a population level, if we could get everybody to make a small change to their health, that would be fundamentally important in the number of people that die from diseases related to eating and obesity. So I don't buy the argument when someone says, oh, it's only small, because at a population and public health level, a small effect is really, really important. And I will always drive towards making small changes, because actually lots of little bits add up to a huge bit.
Mm, I can see that. Would you say that you need a big change, like a big shift in the way you do things to even get that small change? Or, you know, is there a way that you might just want to tweak the current labelling to get that small change? What do you think on that?
Yeah, so, you know, we are looking at that. We are looking at different ways in which we might operate. And actually, if we think about food manufacturing companies, who are in themselves hugely profitable companies, it wouldn't take much to change, reflect and review the way in which we have labelling at the moment, because that's the right thing to do, I think.
Mm, yeah, a continual review. Yeah, always a good thing, isn't it?
Totally. And I think, you know, for example, last year in April, the government brought out compulsory calorie labelling in out of home settings. Mm. So, you know, we're looking to see what impact that has on behaviour. That will take some years for us to be able to see what impact that's had. But in America, they've had the Affordable Care Act for quite some time. So calorie labelling in out-of-home settings has been in place for at least 3 years now, I think. And so we're starting to see the studies come through. And we are starting to see studies that are showing small effects again. But again, imagine a small effect in all of the American population mm-hmm. is massive.
Yeah.
So we'll need to see what impact it has. It's only in England, though. It's mm-hmm. not in the other devolved nations. So we'll wait and see what impact that has.
When it was put in, is that something that you were supportive of? You know, there's testing it and researching it, and then there's putting it right into the public and then seeing how it goes. Were you supportive of it coming in, the calories on menus, for example?
I was, partly because we already have calories on food that's labelled in shops. It's not, this is not a new thing. This is just in an out-of-home setting. So I think, you know, if you go out for a pizza and you've got a choice between two pizzas, for example, then you might want to know that one pizza has 400 calories than the other. I've got a choice then about what it is that I eat. I think I definitely support menus that do have calories and that don't. So if you go into a restaurant and you choose not to, then I think for whatever reason, I think you're entitled to. But I think the default should be with calories.
I was just going to ask that. There's a lot in behavioural science about what the default is, so that people get presented that and then they adopt out for it. So calories on menus should be the default.
Yeah.
So is it a good thing for people to know when they're just going out for a birthday meal, they're just trying to chill, relax, they just want to have the foods that they like, that it's a good thing to still put in front of their face how many calories are going to be in that food? Is that what you would say? It's a good thing?
I mean, I think your example of a birthday meal is quite extreme, I think, because that's a one-off. I think if you go out for a meal a couple of times a month regularly, then I think it should. I think that if you are out for a birthday meal to enjoy yourself, then I think it's okay to request, for example, a menu for whatever reason without it. And I'm okay with that. But I think if you're eating out, and many of us do that regularly, I think, you know, it's important to know what you're eating, not least because food eaten out of the home has many more calories, has much more fat, is typically less healthy than when you eat healthy food at home.
I guess when people are booking into a restaurant, if it's online or, you know, via a form, it could be a little box which says, you know, if you don't want to have a menu with calories on, tick that. Then they're not even presented with the option at the time, I guess.
Yeah.
Something that could be put in.
But potentially, could be.
Different ways to do this
different
sort of
question.
Stuff. And I'm no maitre d'. I can't say what's the best thing for restaurants or anything like that. But today we're, you know, mainly here to talk about quite a different type of labelling, PACE labelling, physical activity calorie equivalent labelling, PACE labelling.
Yeah.
I think not many people listening or watching this would know PACE labelling. So can you explain, you know, what is PACE labelling?
So PACE labelling seeks to demonstrate in physical activity terms the energy that's contained in a food. So it tries to say, okay, if there's X amount of calories in a food item, what would it take in relation to walking, dancing, swimming, whatever activity it might be, are equivalent to the number of calories in a food. So I've actually brought some different examples. So here's a sort of a basic example here. So we can see here there are 345 calories in this food item, and that would take about 70 minutes to walk equivalent and 35 minutes equivalent to run off those calories. So it's not saying you have to burn off all the calories in that food. It's just trying to put in context in a different, easy, understandable way what the calories equates to. It's not saying you have to do that. It's trying to make it more meaningful than just, you know, if I just say, oh, Chris, there's 345 calories in this food, then that doesn't mean anything. How do you know what that means in terms of energy? So it's just trying to put things in context. And whether we like it or not, we have calorie amounts in the United Kingdom. So 2,000 for a woman and 2,500 for a man on average. And so it just allows you to put those numbers in context.
So who are they for, those numbers? Is that based on the average male, female calories per day or exercise per day? Or, you know, how is that calculated? Because I don't see the little thing which says, you know, on average, women should have 2,000, men should have 2,500. So, how's that worked out?
So I'll come back to in a sec that specifically. So we just talked about the number of calories that are recommended each day, 2,500 for a man and 2,000 for a woman. So that's a general term. And clearly, you know, someone small like me may not need 2,000. They might need 1,800, and you might be a slightly bigger man and you might need 2,600. So it works in the same principles. It's based on an average amount of calories. So you can vary it, but typically it might be the average of a female. It might be the average of a man in terms of kilograms. Mm. So it's the average kilograms. You might alter it for children to make it more applicable to them.
Is this going to be on my apple? Is this on every food? Is this on my banana? Is this on my pizza?
Good question.
Where am I seeing this?
So there's two parts to that. We've done some research across the United Kingdom to ask the public about where would you like to see, if it was implemented and it's not, where would you like to see it? And overwhelmingly, the view is that the public would like to see it on really high, dense energy foods, discretionary foods, crisps, biscuits, alcohol was one of the particular other areas. And I think part of that is that the public understand that those are the not so good foods, and that's potentially where they might need a little bit more help with nudging towards making decisions. So that's fine. And so going back to your question, you know, where should we see this? It doesn't make sense to me to put it on a carrot. It doesn't make sense to me to put it on a banana. Those are the foods that we want people to eat. So anything that gets in the way of you eating that is not necessarily good. But the problem that we've got is that when you go into a supermarket or a shop, you're always making decisions between one thing over another, right? So if I've got pace on one item, I want you to compare that the pace or the amount of calories or physical activity is less in one compared to the other. So if you know that a carrot's going to take you 1 minute of running and a chocolate cake is going to take you 20 minutes of running, then it might help or nudge you towards eating the carrot over and above the chocolate cake. And that's probably not a great example, but hopefully you can see what I mean. So in that scenario, you would want pace on the carrot, because then you could clearly see that the carrot is a better option than taking the cake, or, you know, two different types of crisps, one that's low fat, one that's high fat. You know, you can see how you want people to engage in the comparison between the decision making.
Is it mainly meant to be a nudge? You know, it's a cue to nudge people to choose one thing over the other. Or is it, you know, people should be counting how many calories they're having a day and how much they're expending.
Yeah.
And this is a part of that calculation that they would have. Which of those two
Not
is
directly.
It?
I think it can be both. I don't think it has to be one over the other. Whatever cognitive process you go through in terms of making a decision about what to eat is okay. And so for some, that might be calories, and for others, that might be a comparison between one food over another. We're not all exactly the same in terms of how we choose food. So for me, I think it's more about encouraging you to make a healthy decision between different types of foods. You know, we're not really here to encourage people to be thinking, oh, I can only eat 2,000 calories because I'm a woman, and I'm 2,500 because I'm a man. That's not the goal of pace at all. That wouldn't be its purpose.
Do you think, have you got any evidence so far from the research that you've done or other people have done that shows whether the general public, when they look at these, they get the implied nature, as you were talking about, of what this is meant to say? Or do people read it and say, oh, this means I actually have to do this sort of exercise in order to burn off, inverted commas, this food? Because I remember you just saying that there's sort of a lot of implication through those numbers. Have you got any evidence on that yet?
Not specifically in terms of what people think in relation to the amount of physical activity that they can do. What we do know is that they do think, gosh, if I have to do, you know, an hour's running, for example, that chocolate cake isn't worth it. So it's not that they actually believe that they need to do those that sort of physical activity, but it just prompts them to make a decision against taking or eating the cake or whatever it might be.
Have you got any, you know, what is the evidence for pace more broadly so far? Does it work? Does it work for certain people and not others? What is out there at the moment?
So the evidence that we've got, if you were to sort of pile it all together, points towards it being useful. We don't have enough long-term studies to be able to, you know, to sit here now and say categorically it's an absolutely effective approach to labelling food. We do have some initial evidence that suggests that it does encourage you to reduce the number of kind of high calorie foods that you consume. And we also have a couple of studies that also indicate that it makes a difference in terms of weight, only in a small way. But again, small effects in a large population are still really important. So we are starting to see consistently some evidence towards it working. There are studies also that have shown no effect. I would argue that some of the studies that we've got haven't been well designed. And it's really important that we have well designed studies in order to make a decision. When they're not well designed, it's difficult to know what's really going on here. So we do need to up our game as a community in terms of the labelling types of foods that we do. The other thing to say is that a lot of studies have been done in hypothetical scenarios in laboratory or online. What we really need is studies taking place in real context, and we've started to do some of those studies both in adults in children. So for example, we've done a study in school canteens looking at paste labelling. We've done an online study and then we're going to be doing some stuff around vending machines. There are very few vending machines that serve healthy food, so vending machines are a really good context and scenario in which to do it. And vending machines typically are places where we're trying to eat foods that are snacks. We don't tend to eat meals from a vending machine, so that's what we're trying to do.
And do you know if the aim of this is targeted at a particular population or a particular problem? Is it people living with obesity? Is it anyone looking to just manage their weight? Is it an educational tool for the general public to know about it and then make decisions on it? You know, what can you speak to that?
I think my view is that any labelling is for everybody. You know, once it's implemented as a law, then it's something that's important for us all. And even if you're not overweight, you know, you may well still have a tendency to gain weight or not to make healthy decisions. So it can act as a preventative tool. Mm. But equally, if someone's living with overweight or obesity, it might also help and guide them towards making good decisions. And I sort of talked about children as well. I think children are in the mix here, and often when we think about public health policy at a broader population level, their view and their behaviour are often forgotten. The focus tends to be on adults and what's best for them, but actually if we think about children coming through, whatever it might be, whether it's PACE or whatever, we need to think about the implications of interventions for them too, because they're the ones that we worry about the most.
So when I look at this, and I'm 6 foot tall, male, slimish, let's say, slim enough for me, and I think about, you know, do I really want to be sort of guilt tripped into not having the Mars bar that I really like? And you know, it kind of feels like if this is implemented, I'm not sort of targeting this at you at all, but if this is implemented, it'd be seen as a policy thing, it'd be taken politically, because things like that always is. Yeah. And would it be seen by people as the government, the department, whatever it is, of whichever department, are just trying to guilt trip people to buy one product over the other? That's one thing that I can see as a critique, that it's just Yeah. Is it guilt tripping? Is that a good thing?
So I don't believe the Department of Health and Social Care are set up to guilt trip the British people. That department is set up to improve our health, and everybody in it is working and serving to improve the population of the people in the United Kingdom. So, but we need to think about strategies that work, and you know, so I would take exception to guilt tripping. That's not the point. That's not the reason why we get out of bed every day. We get out of the bed every day to save lives and improve lives. Yeah. So I guess I'm going to choose not to answer that question, because I think it's unfair.
I can come further into it then. I'll be a little bit more precise, because you mentioned about, you know, small effects within a population is a really important thing. And you can take that as a positive, but then on the negative, a small effect, a negative effect on a smaller population of the UK is important. Yeah. And I can see with this, people, and this is not just me, I try to do a little bit of homework when I do these podcasts, and I know that there's been a lot of critique about this on the lines of, does it exacerbate people who have symptoms with eating disorders or exercise disorders? Charities have come out and been very vocal to say this is not going to be a good thing. And a part of that is, does it make people, you know, feel guilty, especially with eating disorders, about choosing a certain food when trying to have that relationship with food and try to build positive relationships is something that they try to do? And does that go against it? There's the sort of, does it trigger, you know, whether
people who are in recovery or whether they're in the middle of having eating disorder issues, this obsession again with counting calories, and there's lots, and I can sort of go into it. It's encouraging excessive exercise, restrictive eating, self-perception, body dysmorphia problems, things like that. So where's your stand at the moment on the impact that it has? Not whether that's a good thing or not, if it does, but does it have an impact at the moment on people with eating and exercise disorders?
There's a lot of questions there, Chris.
So one I'll go with the final one. What is the current literature on that?
It's an important question, so I want to answer it well.
Answer it as you would like to.
I think the first thing to say is that it's always important to think about the harms and the positives of any intervention, whether it's labelling of food or any healthcare intervention. So, and the first approach to healthcare is to do no harm, and that has to be at the front of your mind whenever you're thinking about what you do. So I think, you know, it's clear that there are a small number of people let's go with the UK, that are experiencing an eating disorder. And there is no doubt in my mind that that group needs support, and they need proper support in terms of helping them deal with their relationship with food. And I kind of want to say that first and foremost and up front, because it's one of the most asked questions that I get in relation to PACE. And I don't want people to think that I haven't considered it. It is on my mind. It does worry me, as any good citizen working in this area would be. So that's out there. The other thing we've got to think about is, well, we've got a small number of people who experience an eating disorder, but we've also got 60% of the population that are overweight. And many of those people that are overweight are dying of diseases that could have been prevented had they not been overweight. You know, the NHS today will see thousands and thousands of people, because they're overweight. So you have to, in public health terms, you're always thinking, where does the line go? Where do you draw it? On the one hand, you've got this group who clearly needs support. You know, we need to, you know, be actively encouraging this group. But on the other hand, we've got a very large group of people that also need our help too. And my job is to save lives. And I'm employed to think about the people that are overweight and obese. But that's not to say that I'm not concerned about the people that have an eating disorder who, you know, are having a tough time, you know. And I get lots of calls and conversations from lots of parents, not lots, but a few, who ring me up and say, right, Amanda, you've been talking about labelling and PACE labelling in particular, and, you know, my daughter's got an eating disorder and it's going to have this effect and that effect, and it's going to trigger da-da-da-da-da. So, and I've listened to those views. I haven't just disregarded them. But I think it's really important that we get the evidence. We get the evidence around what works best, and then the policymakers can make the decision about what they do next. So I don't know if that answers your question or not. In terms of the evidence, so there's no evidence at the moment that that is the case. And I've asked lots of people, including the charities that you've talked about, show me the evidence that says that labelling food of whatever type leads to an increase in eating disorders, but also unhealthy relationships with food. Because it's not just about the small number of people that have got an eating disorder. Actually, you'd be concerned about the whole population if it led to people having unhealthy relationships with food. Do you see what I mean? If it had an effect in that way.
Yeah, it could increase the number of people, for example. Not so it's important for everyone.
And so that's what I mean. You always have to think about the harms and benefits. So one of the things that we're doing in all of our research is that we ask about those things. So again, we're not being negligent. We build it in, and we're starting to get data in terms of the participants in the studies. And that's not what we're finding. We're not finding a change in the relationship with food, or negative thoughts, or any of those kinds of things that would be indicators of concern, or indicators that someone's starting to move towards kind of an eating disorder. That's so I can only tell you what the evidence is, and that evidence is out there. It's published, you know, it's in high quality medical journals. That's not to say that it isn't there. I'm just saying, based on what we've collected and others, it isn't there.
Yeah, because I know that I had a look up at the impact on just menu calorie labelling. And there was a paper, there was one quote, and I'm not trying to do a typical interviewer journalist thing when I say, like, oh, I've got Steve from Hartlepool, yeah. and Steve does this, and he's been impacted negatively. Yeah. But one of the quotes from the qualitative, the interviews, was, the calories on a label is an extra fight I didn't ask for.
Yeah.
And I'm going to ask it in a different way. Why might pace be different to the negative impact that there is evidence for out there on just calorie labels on menus? Is there a reason why it would be different? Or is it just at the moment, we don't have the evidence? There's not enough evidence to say that pace is, has any negative or positive effect on people with eating disorders?
Well, we have evidence that says in pace studies that it doesn't. I mean, I don't know what the longer terms might be for those people in those studies overall. I can only tell you what we have now. Mm. And it isn't any different. You know, labelling and health communication, it's the same. I guess it's more about your position on something. And I get asked that question a lot, as I've already said, and I always sort of say, lots of things in healthcare are controversial. Lots of things in healthcare might benefit one population over another. And this is just one of those scenarios where we kind of need to make a decision. Where do we draw the line? Mm. You know, IVF was hugely controversial. Chemotherapy was hugely controversial. I mean, could you imagine a life? I always use these examples, but could you imagine a life where we don't have those treatments? Mm. So just because something's controversial and it might have negative effects for one population doesn't mean that we discount it and say, because there's an... Do you see what I mean? It's balance, and it's saying, okay, overall, though, the benefits outweigh the risks. Mm. And for that reason, it might be a useful thing to do. But that still means that people with eating disorders still need to get the support that they need. Mm. Why does it have to be one or the other? Why can't it be both?
Mm. Yeah, I can see that. So if someone has, I think of another population that's been, it's a critique of pace again, but this can be seen as quite an ableist labelling. It only has running, walking, cycling, tend to be thing where people ambulate, walk, etc. with two legs.
Yeah.
And so it's not inclusive of people with physical disabilities in that way. Is there any plans for that to change, or is there a way that you could make it more inclusive, or does it fit into that category again of, it's for this population, but not for that?
So we've got to think about the manufacturers and what they put on their foods. And so there's always going to be a limit to the number of activities that can go on. I mean, I guess, if it was ever implemented, then we could have websites that we do have them now where you can convert. So it might be that we do that. And the same is true for people who, for example, who are blind. So there's lots of work for us to do to make it more accessible. But I don't think we should apply a different criteria to pace labelling than we do for all the types of labelling. And we don't have that now for current labelling. So,
yeah, no, fair point. Do you know where the industry is behind this? Have you had, are they, or are they really resilient because you're going to be saying don't have these foods and, they want you to buy them?
I don't think industry are that keen, but we're... I think industry have to come to the party. We can't do this alone. We have to work with industry rather than against them, because ultimately they're the ones that make the food and the labelling. Industry have massive marketing budgets, and in healthcare we don't, so we're fighting that from the outset. So we've got to bring them with us. I think the goal for industry for us is really reformulation, because if we can reformulate the foods or make them smaller, because of pace, because of the alarming amount of physical activity that it might take, then that would be a good outcome for us. I think we've got to do it with them. We can't do it on our own.
There's a lot of fire associated with this in the media, as in
fire.
You get a lot of flack thrown at you. You take a lot on.
Yep.
Do you take it on the chin, or does it affect you? How do you feel when you get that controversy?
That doesn't bother me so much, the controversy. I think the thing that bothers me the most is when I get phone calls from parents of children who have got eating disorders. You can't not be moved by that. And, you do have to reflect on, is this worth it? And is this really the right thing to do? I For me, I think the right thing to do is to get the evidence and then to make an informed choice and decision about whether it's the right thing to do. I don't think we should just be stopped getting evidence. We need to get the evidence and lay it on the table, and then make that's better science. I'm not into science by opinion. I'm into science by science.
yeah. But it does affect you, as you say, listening to those.
It's not great. Yeah, it's not great. It's not. It's not. And I have in this again, just to show that I am taking it seriously. I have spent time with people who've had eating disorders and with parents. I have listened to their concerns. I have taken them on the chin. I'm not neglecting those, but I also am mindful of the 60-something percent of the population who are dying, and let's not get away from that. Thousands of people, tens of thousands around the world, are dying of diseases, or their quality of life is massively impacted by the fact that they're overweight. We need to address that. This might be one of the ways, there might be lots of other ways, but we can't ignore that in terms of helping the population.
I'd love to tap into more on that. Your experience around the table at the population level in trying to change, make or change policy, because I know that you work as in a team that's part of that work, trying to make the change right at the heart of the government level. What is it like at that table when you've got the one priority, which is do no harm, but you know in some situations that it's going to affect one population, significant but large population, let's say, and then it might have a detrimental impact on one person who you've had on a phone call.
Yeah.
What's that risk tolerance like for negative impact? When does it become not okay? Is there a percentage of the population that is used to say, once it's more than 10% of people being negatively affected by this new policy, it doesn't matter how good it is, we don't do it? Or is it?
I think that's a hard question. I think that varies. If you're on antibiotics and you go to your doctor today, it will have all the benefits and it will have the risks. And at some point, someone's decided that the benefits outweigh the risks. But that will vary depending on what the intervention or what the treatment happens to be. Here we're talking about a population-based intervention. So I can imagine the tolerance would be higher at a population-level intervention where you could get lots of people to benefit. I mean, you're talking about millions potentially, aren't you? Yeah. Relative to, a treatment or something in an NHS context. So I don't think there is a magic number.
But it is considered.
Yeah, it is. So a committee like NICE, for example, will sit and look at the evidence, both pros and cons, and make a decision about whether this is the right thing to do. So the government, for example, last year decided that the right thing to do was to make it law that out-of-home eating settings needed to display calories. I wasn't party to that decision, but I guess the people in that room sat down and said, overall, look, we're going in the wrong direction here with the number of people living with obesity. This may well be one way in which we can help people. Let's start to do that. And also the other thing to say about that is that I know that the government have commissioned research to look at the impacts of that decision over time. So in the next 2 to 3 years, we'll start to see some of those results coming through. So again, it's linked to research, and until you put it into real practice, you can't get real research to see. So there will be some level of risk to get the evidence that you need.
Yeah, and is it going to cost a lot if you implement this at a population level? Is it quite a high cost intervention, or is it actually quite low cost compared to other things that you can
do? To the public purse, it would be very low, because most of it would be manufacturers or retailers that do it. I can't think of many scenarios where it would be a cost to the public purse. I guess schools would be one place where it would, but workplaces, for example, that were funded by the public purse, universities or leisure centres, I don't know, I'm trying to think of places or hospitals or whatever, that would be a cost to the public purse, but it's very, very cheap.
Yeah.
If you think it's very, very cheap and you get a small effect, lots of people, the actual cost effectiveness is a no-brainer.
Yeah, fair enough. And what are you currently exploring then, right now? What's cooking? What's happening in your team? I have to do a food-related plan always, but yeah.
So we've just completed some studies in different contexts, and as I mentioned earlier, vending machines is one of the areas that I'm particularly focused on. There aren't many healthy foods dispensed from vending machines, so I think that's an area to focus on. And you know, we are looking to work with more kind of food retailers to think about paste labelling, or at least trialling it, and to see what impact it has, but also to get real kind of live information about how customers, when they go into restaurants, for example, or fast food takeaways, how they respond to having the paste labelling. Is it as bad as we think? Or is it okay? Do they even look at it? Mm-hmm. You know, is it going to be the same as other types of labelling? I suspect it's more emotive, so I imagine that people will engage with it, but it might engage with it for a short period of time, and then actually they just don't look at it anymore. And then we'll need to think about, well, so what do we do to encourage people to engage with it once it's there?
So there's a lot more that needs to be done before it's going to be implemented at policy level.
Yeah, we're in the phase of trying to gather evidence, what the pros and the cons. And I think, you know, if it ever was implemented, it would be not on its own. It wouldn't be traffic light labelling wouldn't be taken off, or front of pack labelling. It might just be, you know, the little icon in terms of walking, for example, is added, or maybe on a menu it's added.
Okay, and where can people find out more information about this, about you, to watch out for the next bit of work that's going to be coming out? Where can they go?
So we're on Twitter. So the Centre for Lifestyle Medicine at Loughborough is, we have quite a strong Twitter presence. And then we have the website, the Climb website at Loughborough. So you can have a look at some of the studies and some of the media stuff that I've been doing around health communication and some of the links. Done quite a bit of stuff for Channel 4 and BBC around this work. So those are on there as well. So yeah, take a look.
Sounds good. Yeah, do take a look and make an opinion yourself about
exactly.
it. Have a look into it and once your opinion's there, look at what's the science saying, look at what the limitations are, and
totally.
See where we're at. But just turning to you to finish off, you've been very successful in your work, and you are an inspiration to many people.
Thank you, Chris.
Professor at young age, ethnic minority within the UK. So how would you sort of sell your area of expertise to that next generation who might look to you and say, like, ooh, I'd love to be Amanda one day, you know, but why this area? Why what you've done and I'll do
it? So, thank you, Chris, for your kind words. I think for me, I've got the opportunity to save lives through research and to some extent through health policy. And that's an amazing position to be in. You know, when I go home at the end of the day, you know, if you think about what we've done, you think, well, wow, you know, the studies that we're doing could make a population impact. You know, we could change whatever, not just the paced labelling, but whatever the interventions that we're doing, we could make a fundamental difference to the way in which people live their lives. We could help them think about the way in which they eat and help them reduce their weight. You know, we do a lot of weight management studies as well. So I think that's hugely satisfying to think that, you know, you could do research that impacts across the United Kingdom, and actually not just the United Kingdom, but actually across the world. I mean, the work that we do, you know, we make sure it's high quality so that any government around the world can use it to make decisions about health policy.
Well, it sounds very inspiring from my side. Thank you very much, Amanda, for being part of this podcast today.
No problem, Chris. Thanks for the invitation.
Not at all. And thank you very much for listening or watching to the episode. If you've liked it, then feel free to like or subscribe to the podcast on the platform of your choice. And you can also try out our other podcast, Experts in Sport, and you can find a link to that in the show notes. So that just leaves me to say thank you very much once more for tuning in, and we look forward to welcoming you back to another health-focused podcast in the future. Bye-bye for now.